I mean, what happened was back in the 60s, domestic violence got rediscovered. It wasn't discovered for the first time. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt, in fact, recommended whipping post legislation for abusive husbands. They actually voted on it. It was only, I think, three American states that passed it, the closest to me being Oregon. But it goes through what it waxes and wanes. People go back and forth between criminal justice solutions and social work solutions. And the 60s, there was this confluence, the women's movement, the discovery of child abuse through better technology. And so that sort of generated the whole sort of push to, and a couple of really high profile cases where police had not acted on behalf of a woman that was being seriously battered. They all came together to start the ball rolling. And when the ball got rolling, there was no opposition. I mean, the left loved it because it was women's rights, and the right loved it because it was family protection and improving families. So it snowballed, and we got this view of domestic violence, which is that it's male perpetrated against innocent female victims. It maintains the social function of patriarchy. It gets tacitly supported by police and everyone else. And that view came to dominate everything, including the media, including the website of the American Bar Association, which I took down with great glee about 20 years ago. We can talk about that one. But I mean, it just misled a lot of professionals. And, I spent one wave of time back in the 90s when the Violence Against Women Act came out in the US, being flown all over the US by psychologists saying, talk sense to our local funding agents from the federal government. They want us to do the Duluth model and save us from this. So I kept trying to talk sense to these guys. And I have to say, I was raised as a scientist, and the idea was you'd do a polemic and there'd be evidence involved, just like a court case. You lay out your evidence, the other guy would lay out his evidence. My first experience with people totally ignoring evidence was when I got into disputes about domestic violence, because I took on the gender paradigm and basically said, wait a minute, that's not what the data say, and here's what the data say. And then I would run into these functionalist sociologists who would just ignore the data. One of them was a guy called Walter de Casseretti, who actually was in Toronto for a long time, but he's gone to the US now. He actually wrote a book where he put the data tables in and then completely concluded the opposite of what the data tables were showing, in line with the gender paradigm. It was really, really extreme. The bottom line right now, I mean, there have been five major surveys done in the US, representative sample surveys, cumulative sample size over 25,000. What's remarkable about these five surveys is, one, they're independent. Two, they're all methodologically meticulous. Three, they come up with virtually identical findings, even though they were done by different researchers at different times. They ran from 1985 US survey to a 2011 Center for Disease Control in Atlanta survey. Finding was this: that 50% of all domestic violence is bilateral, match for level of severity. 35% is female perpetrated, 15% is male perpetrated. Of that 15% that's male perpetrated, 5% is potentially injurious, about a third. So it would involve punches or kicks or things like that. So that's 5% of all domestic violence. And we based our entire thinking about domestic violence on that 5%.
Don, it's lovely to see you again. We've met in person a number of times. Just want to introduce you and cheers for
Yeah,
joining
I'm
us.
just thinking about the 5%, so
We'll do a
not
simultaneous
much
sip.
makes me quiet. So,
Now, what
sorry,
fascinates
just one sec. So since 2011, has there been anything more substantive in the last decade to try and update what these stats are?
Canada does its survey every 4 years, right? But Canada, being so politically correct, won't ask victims of domestic violence if they've also been perpetrators of domestic violence. can't ask that. So you never do get any measure of bilaterality in Canada. And it, to make matters worse, since the data were definitely not favoring the gender paradigm, and since the government of Canada had based everything on the gender paradigm, including building large edifices across the river from Ottawa, they had a problem. And so what they tried to do was to make it not look so much like it was male victims outstripping female victims by adding the item unwanted sexuality as a severe violence criterion, even though it's not. That didn't matter. So they threw that into the severe violence, kind of hoping, I guess, that it was going to tilt the scale in the favor of female victims. It didn't succeed. And of course, my colleague Alexandra Lysova at Simon Fraser, you know, she and I did a paper 4 years ago on the latest Canadian survey. So the bottom line is no. I mean, it's still not coming out the way the gender paradigm predicts. It's just not there. The data don't, I mean, the best way to think about, there is one variable, demographic variable, that predicts domestic violence to a certain extent, and that's age. You know, you get higher incidence reports if you're surveying 16 to 26 year olds than if you're surveying 46 to 56 year olds. But gender, forget it.
You were asked to speak at the Senate a number of times and give presentations, which a lot of it's in your book, Rethinking Domestic Violence, which is a fascinating book. And in general, you were saying it's usually reciprocal domestic violence, and where it's one directional, it's slightly more to be female perpetrators. And
that's so what the data say.
And the reason,
it's not me making it up. I'm just reciting five well-conducted large sample surveys that have been done from 1985 to 2011.
And one of the reasons that you were asked to give this information is because, you know, the Senate's involved in making laws and, you know, the criminal code. A lot of things are being defined in the criminal code by judges and put into law based on the science that you can disprove, right? Based on studies that don't represent the reality. And so it's important to do that kind of thing so that when they're making laws, they can actually have the real statistics in mind. And this is important for police forces as well. And people would give you extra time to speak, but then it didn't seem to make a difference. I found that so frustrating that they would...
Well, you know, I mean, yeah, just give us your firsthand experience.
Frustrating thing for me has been I've gotten way less recognition in Canada than I've gotten outside Canada. I mean, I'm much better known in the U.S. than I am in Canada.
Yeah,
well, most of my court cases in the U.S.
And when you were giving your evidence to a Senate committee, what was that like?
It was fine. I mean, they just gave me an hour or so to get up and do essentially a short course on domestic violence. And I just, you know, ran through the data. And of course, you know, these data, I mean, it doesn't matter who the audience is. People are always kind of shaking their heads because they're stunned. And what I told you about the five surveys, all audiences are stunned to hear that because they've been so brainwashed to think about something else.
You know, so much, I'm sorry to interrupt, but so much of the policing policies with respect to responding to a domestic violence call and how they assess the situation and who they arrest is based on this false paradigm.
Well, you know, there's a marvelous study that my colleague Deborah Capaldi did in Oregon. Oregon's a dual arrest state, by the way. So it's possible for the police to arrest both participants in a domestic violence issue. And this was something called the Oregon Youth Survey. So they were going back every 3 months and interviewing this sample of couples that were cohabitating. And they were youngish, like late teens, early 20s. But they had tons of data on them because they were going back every 3 months. So they knew for a fact that the majority of these couples engaged in bilateral domestic violence. But what happened is that one day, the level of domestic violence would raise up just slightly above the norm, even for this couple. And they would call the police. And when the police showed up, they arrested the man 85% of the time, even though if you look at the longitudinal data, which Deborah Capaldi had, the female was as violent or more than the man who got arrested. And of course, everybody goes by the police arrest data to say, well, it's 85% of men who commit domestic violence. Well, no, it's 85% of men who get hauled away from domestic violence. I mean, I did one case that, I mean, I really had to double check this myself. I wrote it up. It was in the National Post about 10 years ago. It was a guy in Vancouver, but he was living in Saskatchewan when this happened. And he called the police to report domestic violence. They showed up. He had a knife in his belly. They took him to the hospital to get the knife out, and then they arrested him.
Yeah, I've heard that story, actually, during
a
panel
discussion.
Yeah, I
really had to double. I couldn't believe that one myself. That's when I was still young and naive.
He's got a knife in him, and he's seen as the perpetrator. She doesn't get arrested at all. It's craziness.
Yeah.
Now, you know, what you mentioned before is kind of like circular reasoning, right, where they arrest, you know, 85% of the time it's men. So then they use the arrest rates to say that women are the victims.
You know, 5 years ago, the Toronto Star did a series on why is domestic violence policy not working? And so I couldn't take it anymore. And I wrote in and said to the woman that was writing it, it's because we conceptualize it all wrong. And in fact, you know, it's not the gender paradigm. It's psychological causes, and it's gender neutral. And she said, oh, no, police reports tell us that 85% of the people who are arrested for domestic violence are men. Well, yeah, because the police have been programmed to arrest a man.
Right. Well, you've mentioned before the Duluth model, which was, it's been mostly debunked now. I believe that the people who came up with the Duluth model, it's like a wheel or something, that they've actually admitted that their data was incorrect. But the Duluth model, is that not? Yeah.
The only sort of viable study I've ever seen, there was a policy group in Washington State who actually were able to find about 16 clinically assessed treatments for wife assaulters. I used to do one myself here in Vancouver. I did it for about 12 years, but they did about 16 of them, and about six or seven of them were Duluth model. And they actually showed a negative recidivism factor. That is, the men were more likely to be violent after treatment than before. And the ones that showed a positive recidivism, a reduction in recidivism, were ones that dealt with the kind of psychological issues that I talked about in abusive personality. But I mean, until you start engaging couples in these things, you're kind of losing it, because if 50% of the cases are bilateral, what's the point in just treating one party?
Right. And, you know, there's actually Erin Pizzi from the UK. She was she became well known because of that. She opened the first domestic violence shelter for women.
She's an incredible woman.
Yeah.
And what happened to her was shameful.
Yeah.
Totally shameful. I mean, she had the audacity to suggest there was an interactive pattern involved, which the evidence proves she was right. But yeah, she was shunned. She got death threats. I mean, it was horrible what happened to her.
Yeah. She ended up having to move out of the country because of the threats.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like, you know, and it's hard to get funding in comparison to look into male victims, which these wheels, like the Duluth model and stuff, anything where they, and these groups love to create these wheels. In a one portion of the wheel, it always says patriarchy or male violence, right? It assumes that the wheels don't even consider, they erase male victims right from the beginning.
The Duluth model was written by a woman who was doing a master's degree at OISE, who had no experience with domestic violence, except what she'd learned from talking to women who ran shelters. And she based the whole thing on that. She'd never done any treatment groups. She didn't know the first thing about therapy, not the first thing. And she winds up comparing male-female relationships to master-slave relationships. Master-slave. I mean, I'm taking a quote right out of her book. It was ridiculous. And that's what they imposed by law under the Violence Against Women Act.
Yeah. Well, there was actually a really interesting article written by Barbara Kay for the National Post recently, which was titled Woke Feminists Look to Eliminate Men as a Category of Victim.
Yeah. Well, Barbara's great. You know, I mean, for years, she would actually write to me and ask for research studies before she'd do her columns. I mean, she actually was doing scientifically based points of view, which was startling because I sent her everything I had. And so we struck up a good relationship that way. And I met her a couple of times in Ottawa.
She does great research. And in this particular article, she cites a study by Children and Youth Services Review called Gender and Child Custody Outcomes Across 16 Years of Judicial Decisions Regarding Abuse and Parental Alienation, which parental alienation ties into a lot of criminal cases too, because it can end up going in that direction. We've seen it. But they said among the findings, 90% of abuse allegations in cases of parental alienation were determined not to be true or otherwise unsubstantiated. And this is a study of 50 cases that went to trial. And of those who were found to be abusive, 25 of those people were mothers and 10 were fathers. And this has been supported by other studies. So again, it's what you're talking about. And this is, you know, they're looking at things that go to trial. And like, you know, we've been saying a lot of the times parental alienation do lead to charges of, you know, all sorts that will span over the length of a relationship.
Yeah, Janet Johnston did a really interesting study in San Francisco on that. She found 75% of allegations specifically of child sexual abuse were unsubstantiated. But of course, you know what I mean, the unsubstantiated rate is lower than that in non-custodial issues. It's sort of like 35% or something like that. So yeah, there've been some empirical studies done, and there's no question that parental alienation, I mean, I'm doing a case right now in Los Angeles that, I mean, right now they're trying to decide who the primary aggressor is, which is taking forever. I'm testifying next week, and then the next step after that is going to be custody. And I've seen the testimony of the kids here, and they mimic exactly what mama thinks without any supporting evidence whatsoever. Daddy's a bad guy, and we're not sure why, but we just know he is.
Now, you've been an expert witness a number of times in course, some of them, you know, pretty high profile. You were called to be a witness. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've done closing in on 100 cases, probably about 95% of them in the U.S. Murder cases, custody cases, you name it. I mean, the most high profile was O.J. Simpson, but I mean, Jack Kent Cook was pretty high profile too. That was pretty interesting. And then I did one in New York where the guy that owned Revlon was I actually participated in that case on behalf of his wife because there were allegations of abuse on his part. That was the last time I think Peter Jaffe and I spoke civilly to each other, because we were working on the same side in that case. That was probably sometime in the early 90s.
Yeah. So to be an expert witness, you have to meet certain qualifications, right?
I've never had a problem with that because I've got a pretty impressive research record. Plus, I've been admitted as an expert in like a dozen U.S. states. So, you know, stare decisis kicks in here. I've already been admitted. They're not going to spend a lot of time on it again. You know, they might do age tests to make sure I haven't become senile or something. I mean, the ones that Biden and
you
Trump
sound pretty good to me.
Apart from that, I've never not been. Oh, the only time I didn't get admitted as an expert, it wasn't me. It was the very first domestic violence case I ever did, which was in Prince Rupert, B.C., believe it or not. And it wasn't me, but the judge didn't allow a battered woman self-defense. It hadn't made it yet into the legal lexicon. But that was way, way back.
So there's two factors. I mean, obviously you're qualified, but then they also want to make sure that, well, actually you could probably describe the things that you have to meet to get an expert qualified. It has to be relevant to an issue at case. You can't.
It has to be relevant, and you have somebody of sufficient expertise that the trier of fact, the judge or jury, would not ordinarily be able to understand in their common knowledge. And so you need somebody with some expertise to explain it. It's rigorous, but it's as basic as that. It's important.
I'm familiar with that one.
You know, we had one of our clients assessed and wound up by accident finding out that he had been suffering from complex trauma as a result of course of an abuse of control by his wife, and used that as an aspect of our defense in a sexual assault case that arises out of a high conflict divorce. And that was a first in Canada, which to me
That's
sort
amazing.
Of, well, it is, because just how rejected the whole idea is, you know? Fortunately, in this case, it didn't raise any eyebrows because we had a lot of very good sourced evidence. These messages were, we had a robust source of information. but it just underscores how alien of a concept this is. And I, you know, as you're talking about this, I'm sorry, I keep thinking about tomorrow. We have a gentleman coming in, which it's just a stark example of what both you and Diane are talking about, who is in the midst of a divorce. The children are with him right now. Wife comes over to the house screaming and yelling, and an altercation happens where he tries to remove her from the house. Police are called.
More domestic violence charges.
They literally just walk in. They say, look, sir, please don't say a word. Our body cams are on. It's not going to help. Don't bother showing us anything. You're under arrest, but you'll be released soon. And that's the standard here. That's the standard. And I've tried to discuss this, you know, to have more of a helpful discussion about why police are not allowed. But they're just, in my opinion, it's not a matter of resourcing, it's a matter of policy. That they are just not told to do an investigation and to try and do something. And he's coming in with about 3,000 messages that are temporal in time to this incident, and video and audio recordings, which will be relevant. And he'll forever have a criminal notation on his computer system, on the police system. But all this underscores how alien a concept, how indoctrinated our society is. Our politicians buy into it for votes, and our police service, and to get budgets and all that other shit. They just
I'm
buy
the
into
last
this.
Person you need to tell that to. I mean,
no, I know. It's just,
get, I mean, given that when I told you about those five surveys, I mean, if you tell a jury about that, already you're giving information that is beyond the ken of the average juror, because they've got the gender paradigm in their head.
Yeah, your work is meticulous, and you know, I know you worked with a number of other people doing conferences, other academics, and I think Murray Strauss was sort of part of this, you know, lecture group that would go around, and you're like, there's a lot of people who've come to the same conclusions as you.
Murray was great. I mean, he got, you know, another guy who got really mistreated for just reporting data.
I know.
Honestly, reporting data. I mean, he got a research prize at the American Sociological Association. The first two rows got up and walked out in protest. I mean, I see it going on every day right now, but
well, there's a couple of things, like Joseph mentioned coercive control being a factor in one of our cases, with the male person being the one who suffered in that particular relationship. And there's been movements to try and put coercive control into the criminal code and make it a crime.
Yeah, in England they did that, didn't they?
Yes,
yeah.
They did.
Well, yeah. One of the concerns when they were looking at it in Canada is, and some feminist groups were saying they were concerned that women were going to find themselves being charged with it, because coercive control is something that women engage in quite often. And so they were concerned about what the effect would be in terms of women being charged. What are your thoughts on coercive control?
You know, the case I'm doing right now is smack dab. That's exactly what's going on. And fortunately, the guy was able to save 4 years worth of text messages between him and his wife. And it's coercive control like you wouldn't believe. I mean, if this guy's trying to run his business, look after his daughters, the wife stays in bed all day and demands he bring her food on a 24/7 basis. And it's not there in time. She excoriates him like you'd believe, but a lot of people wouldn't believe.
Right.
Terrific coercive control. But fortunately, got the text messages, and I'm kind of hoping that that's what's going to save the day for this guy.
Is this a custody dispute case? Or
right now, they're trying to decide who's the primary aggressor, but it's going to morph into a custody dispute pretty soon.
It's amazing if you are not journaling and saving your messages and trying to create objective evidence during the course of a relationship where you can finally recognize that you're the victim of coercive control. Because without that, a male would never be able to defend themselves.
Well, this guy didn't recognize it, and for two reasons. One was it happened incrementally. It kept getting worse and worse and worse. But it's like, you know, the fish boiling to death in water. The temperature goes up gradually. And that was one thing. The second thing was he had an alcoholic mother. So he had this little program in his head about taking care of the woman, his mother, and then the wife. And his wife had some kind of injury, but it wasn't death-defying or whatever. But he was in this role of caretaker, and that fitted naturally with him. So he started doing it and trying to do it. But it just kept getting worse and worse and worse till it was, he couldn't possibly live up to all the demands. And then she'd excoriate him for not being capable of doing the impossible.
And it's just so interesting psychologically how for a man in those circumstances will not be able to recognize that they're in the role of caretaking, which is sometimes what men like to try and do, and then it'll creep up on them only at the time that the shit hits the fan.
That's exactly right. I completely agree with that. I've just seen it over and over again.
Yeah, I see it so often in many of the cases that come to us. But it's a very interesting psychological factor that, again, courts like to ignore. And I just want to discuss one more thing. You know, when we talk about parental alienation and what work or studies you've reviewed on that, have you run across in domestic assault trials or anything where there is the context of parental alienation? Let's say you have an allegation of a child against the alienated parent of sexual abuse. Do the courts recognize to any extent in the criminal context that would be a motive to fabricate?
They do. I mean, at least, again, all my experiences with the U.S. courts. But I mean, if the Janet Johnson study in California said that sexual abuse allegations against the child were brought up in 23% of all of the custody cases in San Francisco, but only 6% were corroborated, and only 6% did the judge go along with that decision. So 75% of the time, the judge is saying, no, I don't buy it.
See, because I've been relying on Canadian case law, and in the cases that we've ran, you know, judges will recognize the issue, but be very loath to actually say it. So they'll say, yes, we understand the defense put forward this motive of parental alienation. Maybe that's true, maybe that's not true, but then wind their way up to a not guilty verdict. It's only in rare cases where a judge will actually come out and say something, but rare. I would say courts are reticent to say that it is an actual motive to fabricate for a child making an allegation or for the other parent in a criminal case. I that's just what I find. And I haven't spent the time on U.S. criminal case law. So that's why I was just asking. But it's not evolving here with my in my opinion. Which is dangerous. This is great.
Yeah. Well, what's your experience? Because you were saying that the U.S. is further ahead than Canada.
I don't know. I wouldn't say that necessarily.
It's no, I think it is.
It varies state to state.
True enough. Yeah. What have you found really makes the most difference in terms of trying to get this information before the lawmakers and so on?
Some acknowledgement.
Yeah.
You know, I can only do what I know how to do, which is to, you know, get up there and talk about the scientific evidence and how powerful it is and what it means, and not go too far afield in the interpretations I draw from that evidence. I try to make it really fact-based and understandable, even for someone who, you don't have to have an advanced degree in multivariate statistics to understand the stuff. That's really all I can do, and that's all I really ever have done in a lot of these cases.
Well, I've noticed looking up the history behind certain legislation that they call people for witnesses, and they have tons of people who want to make presentations before the government while they're crafting the laws and such. Do you think it's a numbers game where there's more feminist-based groups that come and make submissions, and so it outnumbers the people who have the facts that you do?
There's more people presenting a feminist perspective. There's way more data that supports the non-gender paradigm point of view. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, you know, I think I talked about this American Bar Association website that they had up in the early 90s, and it was dispelling the 10 myths about domestic violence. It dispelled them all in the gender paradigm direction. Well, 8 of the 10 myths were dispelled using a government publication that had no data whatsoever. And the other two involved the confusion of allegations with convictions, which I found very strange for a law website. And anyway, said all that in print, and they took it down. I don't know what else to do.
Yeah, like when I was saying numbers too, I mean, like, you know, in terms of the number of voices speaking from certain, because they have like opposing points of view. And it just seems to me that if you were to have 10 people doing, you know, submissions on some upcoming legislation. You probably, on anything to do with domestic violence, you're probably going to have, you know, at least 7 of them with a feminist perspective that are based on things like Deleuze.
Well, in Canada, if not all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if there's a single unified voice speaking to the contrary. I mean, trying to get a study done. Go ahead, Don.
Just me. I might be the only one.
No, you are. I mean, you know, yeah. We've had some contact with somebody that we're trying to engage with to do a study, but there is nothing going on. It just will not be something that will be funded or undertaken at all. And that's because we're just sheerly outnumbered and politically outgunned that way, because it is not politically expedient to say the opposite.
Yeah. Which is why it's so great to have you on the podcast, so that more people can get to know about your work. And you know, what you have to say is so important, and you're so knowledgeable. I mean, you can just spout off all of the data and know the time frames and everything just off the top of your head. And you've done so much amazing work, and it's so helpful to have that information out there. So I hope people will get your book and look into your work. And I know you've got some lectures that you've done that are available on YouTube as well. So.
Yeah, I think they got the talk I gave to the Senate is on YouTube, so that
yeah.
was useful. Ann Cools gets the credit for that.
Yeah, she was great.
Well, thank you for the hard work that you've done and the continued hard work that you're doing, and thank you very much for coming on to the podcast. This was excellent to have you.
Glad to do it. Call me anytime.
Well, we will. We will bother you if you don't mind.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Bye for now.
Be well, Dawn. Take care. Thank you so much. I think it just underscores how challenging it is to change a paradigm, to change a view that has become ingrained and has been, you know, fed to politicians and fed to police services and fed to the public over a long period of time, where it's, you know, antithetical to a politician's success to try and challenge these policies or legislation. It's not going to change. And you know, we often try and say, based upon our own cases and our own experience, it is, you know, both, you know, any gender,
yeah.
You know, it's not exclusive to one or the other. You know, statistically speaking, we may see higher numbers over the last decade with male perpetrators, but it's still not something which is overwhelmingly male perpetrated. It's just not. I mean, from our own anecdotal evidence, which is a lot of cases, we see that it's, you know, bilateral abuse. We've represented females who are charged, some which legitimately, males who are charged legitimately, and many who are charged, the majority of which in our practice are wrongfully accused. It's disheartening when we have somebody coming in to see us and says, you know, the police, who I'm sure were nice officers coming in, can't do anything but just arrest, and now we have to try and undo a mess which is going to be hard to undo, and then we won't be able to help the individual with the notation that's on the computer system. And I want to say this again for this episode, because it comes up often, and again I'm asked over and over, you know, can this just be taken off? And the answer is no. You know, many police services in Ontario, like Toronto, will keep the notation that somebody was charged, even if it's withdrawn or they're found not guilty. The pictures and prints will not be purged, and that can be used in a vulnerable sector search. You know, any government agency, U.S. authorities, etc., can have access to it. So it's very hard to get that removed, if not impossible. That will always stay there.
Yeah.
And the idea is that one person could be, you know, the next serial killer, and so that's their impetus for keeping it. But when you have these types of policies in place, it's life altering. A false charge will have still an ongoing impact and trauma, and that you just can't undo. And I don't want to sound depressing right now, but this is a perfect example where, you know, somebody who's done rigorous research and looked at, you know, scientifically valid, reliable studies, and has the results that are just not accepted.
Yeah, well, it's important that policy, charging policies and laws are all based on facts instead of based on politics. And I think that's the biggest problem right now. But
yeah. Oh, well. Thank you all for watching. I hope you found this interesting. We thank Don Dutton for coming on. It's been great to have him. And I know you've been corresponding with him. So if you've liked this episode, please like, share, subscribe, hit notification. Did I get that right? I'm not doing pillow talk tonight. but again, you know, when these drops, we have the live messaging and discussions, which is great. We really like that. And a lot of people have reached out to us over the last month through email about their issues. And we love that. And it's given us great ideas for other episodes. So thank you very much for all your support and viewership. Have a good night.